only.
10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Lift off. We have a lift off.
Up. Only.
Hello and welcome to Up Only TV. I'm Ledger. Kobe's on the line. We've got the president of Jump Crypto, kind of Caria on the line as well. We're excited to have him. Not like we got anything to talk about. We'll get to it in just a second. First, I want to tell you about FTX. Go to uponly.tv/FTX. Thanks to FTX for being our exclusive partners for all things that we do on UpOnly TV. You can make a trade today on the FTX app, track your portfolio, go to your local Chinese restaurant and get some custom fortune cookies sponsored by FTX as well. go to uponly.tv/FTX. Kobe, you obviously don't follow every single tweet that I put out, but I went to lunch with a friend of mine yesterday. We went to a local amazing Chinese place. Free ad, Red Pearl in Alabama. and at the end of the meal, I opened the cookie. It's got a freaking FTX logo on the back of it. They are legitimately shipping the fortune cookies, I guess, all over the country. Yeah.
Wow. Well, there you go. Those fortune, you got loads of them. I thought maybe you were selling them to like local.
I legitimately had almost taken them by there to just give them to him because I'm like, what am I going to do with like 1,000 fortune cookies? But they have their own, so there you go.
I liked it at the start of the episode when you said we've got the president. You should have just stopped there. We've got the president. What does the president do? What does president mean?
Well. Oh, sorry. Is that a question for Ledger or for me?
No, that's for you.
No, yeah, for you. We know what the real president does.
Yeah, they do nothing.
For the most part, yeah. It's a jump I get to work on, like, a lot of, like, the fun 0-to-1 stuff. In crypto, we've been doing a lot more than trading. We've been building in the space, of course. Womo's one of those examples. We invest. We kind of have new business lines, and I get to work on a lot of that stuff and help push that forward. And so it's a bit of everything.
It don't sound like a real job. Ledger, are you convinced?
We can let him roll with it.
All right, I just fixed my audio. Apparently my audio sounded weird, so it should be better now. All right, so outside of what is a president, I need to go one simpler question. What is Jump? Because like Jump, like I didn't hear about it very much in my early days in crypto. And now I find out you've just been taking money from me all this time and you're like cleaning up on the markets, making hundreds of millions a day or something. I thought I was giving it all to Arthur, but apparently I've been giving some to you as well. It's like, what is Jump? What does Jump do? How long has Jump been in crypto, et cetera?
Yep. So Jump Trading is a prop firm founded about 20 something years ago in the pits at the CME. Today, one of the largest quant trading firms in the world. Trade, you know, everything that moves. Been in crypto for over 6 years now. And so the crypto effort started as like an intern project at this Skunkworks Labs thing that we have at the University of Illinois. And there was like a, you know, mining rig in the closet and VR project to abstract away trading screens. And also this intern project to explore like crypto market structure and build tools. And, you know, that grew into, you know, what Jump Crypto is today. We've got over 140 people full-time at Jump Crypto, and primarily like two buckets of the business. One is prop trading, exactly what we do on the other side of the house. So, you know, build quantitative models, scale that globally across all the crypto venues, make markets, take on the markets, kind of exactly what you'd expect. The second piece of the business, which I'll say, you know, is even probably closer to the heart of where, you know, Jump Crypto is right now, is the build and strategic piece. And so we're building in the space, we're investing in a bunch of stuff, and we're partnering with a lot of projects. We launched the Jump Crypto brand publicly sometime last year. Jump has traditionally been super quiet. You know, there hasn't really ever been a reason to talk about making markets. But in crypto, you know, you're building and you're partnering and, you know, there's all this community stuff. And so we decided that it would be good to kind of have a voice there. And so, you know, we've been publicly very involved in the Solana ecosystem, in Terra, recently in Oasis, a lot of exchange on-ramp, off-ramp plays globally, some infrastructure stuff, and, you know, with Pit Network, which is Oracle project on Solana, and Wormhole, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get a chance to chat about a bunch.
Who wins in a cage match, Jump or Alameda?
Yeah. Depends on the rules.
That's awesome. But like from a size perspective, there's some people in the chat that are like, hey, what the heck is Jump? Y'all do a significant percentage of total crypto market volume as a market maker, right?
Yes. We're pretty active on most crypto markets. We're amongst the larger participants on all of them. We've deployed billions of dollars of capital into the space over the last many years, and we intend to keep doing that. So
yes,
rough sense of scale.
And I'm curious, kind of how your view of crypto evolved over time. Like, were y'all skeptics when you first entered, and then you became believers, and then you saw problems that you wanted to solve, or what was the process like?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Crypto was like a fun trading problem to solve at the start. The Jump management was like super interested. There's this new asset class. It's got these decentralized properties. So they bought a bunch of Bitcoin, and they were like, we can create this sandbox trading problem for the new hires to, experiment with models and infrastructure without fucking everything else up. And that, so the interns, like, I was one of the only interns back then. And we were building a bunch of the gateways and feeds and connecting to Gemini and getting support from the troll boxes. And like, it would take like 2 weeks to get a reply from anyone in an exchange. And in 2017, the ARBs blew up and the desk got rolled into a full-time team in Chicago because this intern project started to make some money. And it was, mostly an extension of the trading business. And so applying your quant models, applying your market making models to the crypto markets with, all adjusting for all the market structure nuances. And, it was super capital intensive. Obviously, everything's pre-funded in the space. Sam talks about it all the time. Those ARBs, it was exciting. And as, the involvement in the space started to grow, a lot of the team is, quite young and, excited about a lot of the problems in the space and coming at it from, a bit of a more crypto-native perspective. And we started, as DeFi started to become a thing, we started realizing, there's these, resource-constrained environments where these complex financial product protocols are being designed with these interesting system design problems. And that kind of sounds familiar, right? And that's the environment that we're working in every day. And we started working on a more liquidity focused aspect with a bunch of these guys. And then we were talking to them more and we're like, we probably have some useful things to say to these people. And, one thing led to the next and we were writing code and just getting iteratively more involved. Right. And so that's kind of the natural path to it.
I have to ask, CMS intern's probably listening now, taking notes, and he wants to know, how did you go from an intern at Jump to the president of 140 person division in a multi-billion dollar company or however big y'all are?
Yeah, even though Jump's like 1,200 people, it's an ultra, ultra flat organization. And so you're never two, three levels away from the owner. That's about as flat as it goes. There's engineer, manager, and probably owner. That's kind of as high as it goes. And in a very trading focused unit, when you get a lot of freedom to explore ideas and to build stuff, and everyone's we've got good engineers, great quants, and you work on things and things start working, they start becoming good revenue drivers, and you get more resources to throw behind it, and you keep building, and then you build the next thing and that works and you get more resources, and that kind of snowballs, right? And It was awesome because I got to work on some software stuff early on. I worked on the quant models in crypto very early on. And then I got to start working on partnerships and, working on more crypto stuff. And so it was an opportunity to synthesize what we had and then apply it to crypto and just kept doing that over and over again. And so it's kind of awesome. It's the fact that they put that much faith in me, it feels great. And yeah, the team keeps growing and it's fun.
Nice.
What kind of people are you adding to the team? So if there's people listening and they're like, I want to go, they want to steal your job, they want to go intern to president, what type of people are you hiring? What does it mean to work at Jump?
Yeah, most people at all modern quant trading firms are either engineers or quants, right? So engineers or data scientists, and the engineers are the systems engineering kind of guys. So C++, Rust is kind of new and now more important to us because of everything in crypto, but just guys that want to solve like really hard problems. Everyone works really hard at Jump, so you know it's like you're all in all the time, working on fun stuff. And so yeah, the engineer and quant stuff, you know, we always opportunistically, you know, try to bring the best people on. But with Jump Crypto, there's all these other new dimensions now. Like we recently hired a CMO, which is like, you know, super weird for a firm that like the only PR person we had before this had an express job of keeping us out of the news. And so now we have a CMO who's like, you know, maybe helping us to like, you know, talk more. And so he's hiring his big team. He's awesome. He came from Hinge. He was a CMO there. And now he's helping us build this brand. Slightly different brand, but you know, it's interesting.
If you met on Hinge, we don't need to know about that, but I see what you mean. He ran marketing at Hinge as well.
Yep. He was the CMO at Hinge.
He didn't meet on Hinge. Got it.
Yep.
Does Jump have peers in the industry that didn't make the crypto jump, like maybe didn't believe or didn't see the opportunity, or you know, maybe as the regulators thought it was just going to go to zero, that are now late and trying to get in and trying to copy trade, or are they sticking with the conviction that this is just vaporware?
You know, everyone's kind of in right now. There was a couple of folks that came in early. You know, Cumberland was pretty early with DRW. They were doing a bunch of the OTC stuff. And you know, there was a bunch of other firms, you know, participating on the prop side. I feel like there hasn't been as many firms that have committed to building as much yet. But you know, they're all in on Pith. Like all the competitors that we, you know, hate and never talk to, now everyone picks up the phone and like, you know, they're helping contribute like data to this open source Oracle project, this piece of infrastructure. We recently had like a Pith Network workshop in Chicago, and like 90 people from TradFi, like who would never talk to each other, all came together and they're like learning Solana and like, you know, talking to us about how to get more involved and that kind of thing. So it's pretty cool. I think a lot of people are going to come in, and everyone that was on the sidelines up until now is also pretty much in at this point. So,
what about you, Ledger? Are you thinking of joining this TradFi world? You got the skills for it?
I don't think I have the skills from a development side of things, or even a trader side of things. So I'd have to like go beg for a job in marketing and, you know, put together brochures, beg for like podcast stuff. I don't. That'd sound fun to me.
After you, I was reading something from the chat. But
yeah, I was just still thinking about that transition, and you know, y'all had the benefit of being early. And one of my questions is from a market making side. You know, in legacy, you're used to tiny wins that you stack a whole lot of times. And from my understanding, for people that knew what they were doing, it was kind of easy mode for a while in crypto. And I wonder, like, is it still easy mode? When did it start getting harder in crypto to make as much money, and what's that process been like from a competitive standpoint?
Yeah, you know, easy mode never lasts. You know, the markets are like, you know, pretty competitive. There's lots of smart people, and so even when it was easy mode, you know, there was like a lot of problems on like moving your money around. Like exchange won't pick up your phone. They won't like give you your funds for 2 weeks, and it's all tied up, and you can't move stuff around, can't open an account. There's all those kinds of things going on when it was just the simple vanilla ARBs. You know, then it kind of evolved into some of the basis. Now the markets are pretty intelligent. You know, there's a lot of Jump's competitors that are also in the markets playing with Sirius Alpha. But, you know, being early helps, obviously. And, you know, that's what everyone understands. And so you got to just keep it's going down the exact same path that traditional markets went down, right? We're not all the way up to wireless towers throwing messages around and FPGAs co-located with Binance, but, you know.
Is there any corner of the market that's safe? Because like when I got into crypto, it was just, you know, me and it felt like me and a few hundred other idiots trying to take money from each other in a circle. And, you know, the competition, there wasn't tons of smart competition. And as the markets have got larger, I've found I haven't got smarter. I've actually got dumber. So I've instead tried to retreat to parts of the market where I feel like I have a more of an advantage, expand my horizon, I guess, my time horizon. Is there parts of the market where Jump or Jump's peers, or you know, the competition is still unsophisticated, or there is more opportunity for less intelligent people like me to take advantage?
Well, you know, the the big thing here is that jump, and most traders are playing on different time horizons, right? Like the higher frequency shops are trying to enter positions and exit in like under a minute, 2 minutes, seconds, you know, depends on like what the time horizon of the trade is. And, you know, minutes kind of being the very long end, the very, very long end of this. And so, you know, it's kind of compressing down, and your alpha on, you know, understanding the 3-3 psychology, and, you know, that's not baked into all the quant models yet. And so, yeah, I think that piece is, that piece still, you know, it's for the degens, it's for the natives, and it's out there. A lot of the yield farming stuff, you know, I don't think there's like a ton of people from the traditional world kind of who can really get comfortable with all the smart contract risk, with all the legal risk, and kind of all that other stuff going on. So I think those parts of the market are, you know, not as evacuated of oxygen yet. So
do you think that happens over time? Like people get put together like risk frameworks for dealing with smart contracts, and that gets more efficient?
Yeah, it's got to happen. You know, there's like stupid amounts of money being made. And so when there's that much capital at play, like, you know, people figure it out. So yeah, without a doubt.
And then, so how long until like Jump has got people playing DeFi kingdoms and like farming, you know, like P2E games in like just in like cubicles, like nonstop all day, all night? Is that the future?
Well, I hope not, man. I hope not. Yeah, no, I think, you know, you kind of also have to like stick to like where you have a bit of an edge and where you have strength, and just double down, because you can play everywhere. You know, we do try to play a lot of places. We're 140 people trying to play bigger, and, you know, a lot of people are. But yeah, DeFi Kingdoms is not within the alpha.
When you're making markets, like how do your systems know what to do? How much does it require? How much does it require, like, a person behind a desk to turn some knobs, or, you know, like, tell the system how to react versus it just knows? Kobe, I'm an idiot.
I'm listening.
The listeners are also idiots, so I have to ask idiotic questions.
How does computer know what to do?
How much manual massaging is required, like in management of daily market rate? You know what I'm asking, so I'll just shut up.
Yeah, well, I think there's like a spectrum of strategies, right? There's some that are highly automated, highly, highly alpha driven. There's some that require more massaging and intervention. I guess it's like a good opportunity to like, you know, clarify how like these, how the building of these strategies at a very high level even works. And so, you know, generally you have an alpha building process where you're trying to build models that can predict the price on some time horizon, and say it's like 10 seconds, right? So you have all this archive data, you have these machine learning models, you know, you spit a bunch of grid jobs out, and it's all these computations going on that should result in a predictive model that has, you know, a decent chance of predicting what the price is going to be on that time horizon, right? You take that model, you plug it into a strategy, you figure out how to execute on that prediction, and then you scale that out across the world and participate as aggressively with as much size as is reasonably possible, right? And when you're running like a lot of strategies, you can't like just hand tune each one of those. And so there's a lot of quantitative processes that go into sizing, alpha building, like all those kinds of things. But then, you know, there's also like I was saying, the 3-3 stuff. I mean, there's things about the markets that the models just don't know about. And when you do know about those things, then, you know, it's up to the traders, you know, who kind of have the pulse of it to tweak the knobs and react appropriately. So,
yeah. One of the things that happens is like, you know, market's normal and the book gets pretty tight or whatever, and there's a decent amount of money on both sides. Kobe just is laughing at my stupidity. But then something.
I'm just hearing you explain how markets work. I love Like, very sophisticated answer. And then you're like, look, so there's some bids on one side.
So, an event comes along, and then like the order book just spreads out. It's like you guys disappear. You're the people disappearing off of the book. So is it a model that detects variations in activity and is just kind of algorithmically understanding that you don't know exactly what's happening in the market, but you know the market's doing something, you know, different, so you have to spread out in order to maintain profitability?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. So the price models that I used to, like, you know, make market making models, the liquidity models, are also similar to the ones that I kind of described. And so you have models that are trying to predict the price. And if you think the price is going to be very different from where it is right now, you don't want to be providing liquidity on the bid and the offer, right? You want to get out of the way because you think the price is not going to be there anymore and it's going to be a bad trade for you. And so as vol goes up, as you know, various factors into the model change, the model attempts to get out of the way, get up and you know, not sit on adverse flow. Now that's different in situations where you have like dedicated liquidity providers who are just, you know, sitting there at all points in time trying to, like, you know, provide some liquidity, even in adverse events. And, you know, you're just and those folks are just sitting in there and taking the flow and taking the L because, you know, that's part of what they're doing, and they hope to make it back on the spread when it's better. And it's okay.
And how does that change when you get into DeFi markets and liquidity provision in on-chain stuff? Because it's, you know, significantly different structure than an order book.
Yeah, I mean, so if you go to like the AMM models, like the XYK stuff, there isn't really any getting out of the way, right? Like you just stick your money in, and that's about it. And so that's not really where, like, you know, any sophisticated trading participant has edge in providing liquidity. You know, it's a LP positions have a negative expected value if you believe that the assets are going to be uncorrelated, right? And so your kind of liquidity strategy has to be maybe more taking focused, or maybe you just take the L because you have some vested interest in making that thing liquid and usable. Or, you know, if you have something like UniV3, then you move your orders around and you do things with it. But on Ethereum, like paying $100 to move a quote, like it's not going to work out. And so,
so what are you bullish on in terms of on-chain stuff? Like, where do you think liquidity will exist long-term? Like, if it's something's negative EV forever, then you just have to have these people that are incentivized in other ways. So what do you think would make on-chain markets work well in the long-term?
Yeah, you know, with scaling everywhere, you know, this is on L2, L1, everywhere. You're seeing more space for on-chain order books. You're seeing more space for concentrated liquidity, and then that lets sophisticated people come in and make markets and be tight, you know, and widen out and make it a good trading experience. Like, you know, you don't need to have a flat 30 bip fee on everything. You know, if the market's super quiet and, you know, things aren't going on, you can come in a lot tighter, and hopefully that leads to better outcomes, right? And so, yeah, I think long term you'll consolidate around some more expressive structures.
When you talk about this stuff, the only thing I can think about in my head is like the human element. Like, you know, there's 140 people, I don't know how many strategies, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of strategies running, which I guess are owned by certain people. Plus you do on-chain stuff. So there's like key management things to do, like, I guess, multi-sigs like across the company held by different people and stuff. I'd love to hear a bit about how that works. Like, what stops someone making like the biggest L and losing like $1 billion and then coming into work like, Mr. President, I fucked it.
Before I dive into that, like, a large part of the 140 are focused on building stuff and investing in research, right? Like I was mentioning at the start, like that's even more closer to the heart of like the crypto business for us. But there's still obviously a good chunk of people that's very focused on being, you know, kind of big in the markets and participating like very meaningfully there. And so on that piece, we lean like pretty heavily on like all the risk practices that Jump's kind of built over two decades. You know, there's very mature risk management that's been put in place. You know, the trial by fire of like, you know, the 10 quant firms that are still around, you know, there's been insane numbers of blowups, you know, the most famous one being the Knight Capital one, where they just spun on a loop and, you know, bled $400 million and, you know, then they had to get acquired. And so translating a lot of that risk here, you know, was a structural advantage. It's obviously, it doesn't all translate one-to-one. You know, you have pretty insane systemic risk by keeping all your funds across exchanges. You know, you guys have been around in this space forever. You've, you know, probably lost money in this space, like at exchanges, and you know, that's all part of playing the game. You know, there are risk managers that set these metrics. There are multiple people that are, you know, the strategy developers encode those risk metrics in. They're pretty hard coded in. Like, there isn't really a way for one person to like just come in and put on a 10,000 Bitcoin position and then just kind of screw things up in that fashion. Of course, it still happens, and that's why you got to have smart, kind of responsible people.
I'm poor enough that I don't even know how many digits that would be in dollars. 10,000 Bitcoin. I can't do that.
I don't think that's related to your net worth, mate. That's like simple mathematics, isn't it? 10,000 times 45,000.
I'm not doing that math in my head right now, Kobe. It's not an exercise that I've practiced. All right. So another element of the market that I'm curious your opinions on is just the options market. Is it still super immature in your mind in crypto? Do you think it's maturing enough to be interesting, to be impactful maybe, when you have OPEX or whatever else? what do you think about let's start with the centralized options market first.
Yeah, there's not so much going on, man. You know, obviously Deribit has like a lot of like the options volume, it's consolidated there. It's just so much smaller than everything else in terms of the market structure in crypto right now. Like the perps have been where all the leverage seekers have consolidated. For one reason or the other, there's just very little in both the centralized and decentralized worlds going on right now. We made some bets kind of, early on platforms and stuff that, could end up playing a role there. And, we'll keep doing it. I mean, just because it hasn't worked in the past doesn't mean it won't work now, especially with new classes of participants coming in and that kind of thing. But not so much going on right now.
I'd love to know how you see trends that you see in crypto that are not playing out the way you would expect. So things where you kind of think the market is wrong in a sense, like you would have perhaps expected, NFT aggregators to be really big by now, but everything's still concentrated on the new Ponzi website and OpenSea. Or, people still prefer Uniswap V2 over V3, at least like retail volume seems to go through V2 a lot more. Those kind of things where just stuff is not playing out as you'd expect, and you think that will correct over time?
Yeah, there's been a couple, man. So like early on, we were like building for this big institutional narrative. So we built like probably the first like highly electronic OTC desk in crypto. And so you can do like many thousands of trades per second coming through, whatever size, building for, the institutions to come in and buy, and kind of like, struck on that forever. And that was like a narrative that just never played out to like the extent that you'd like, right? And obviously we're making lots of bets and we're not hitching our wagon to one thing. And so that's one thing that like never played out quite so greatly. I think that kind of flipped recently with Solana, where, I think the run up from like, the $10 billion to the $70 billion market cap was very Web2 VC and like, institutional driven. And so you can see the capital kind of, coming into the fold. And it making a big difference. But I think the institutional narrative was a little bit slower than we had expected to play out. We made some bets on infrastructure and like plumbing and pipes to like do WeBops and, connectivity for, folks that don't want to build all their own infrastructure. I think those were maybe ones that didn't play out quite as expected. How long Uniswap V2 liquidity has continued to be incentivized by all the new tokens being dumped on it. Didn't predict that. I'll tell you that. That's the one that continued to surprise me. Now I kind of get it. But it was like, especially when we first looked at Uniswap and we were like, that's just like, so inefficient. And like, there was all these theoretical things. And for like a good few months, we just like missed the fact that it was enabling something cool. And so that's definitely been one of them. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess the opposite question is like, what have you nailed? Like, what do you think this is going to play out when a lot of people doubted that and you stuck to that conviction? And I guess you've seen it happen over time.
I think like one that jumps to mind is like Terra. We always thought like decentralized stablecoin is interesting. I think it's like a bit of like a middle of the bell curve view to point out the fact that it's highly reflexive. Like it is. I mean, that's obviously the incentive mechanism. That's the way it's been laid out. But there's like human elements outside of it, right? And there's the fact that you're trying to make it like get adopted as money everywhere. And a lot of ecosystems are now adopting it as like a code currency, basically, for a lot of their DeFi ecosystem. Exchanges have code assets, it's in payments, fintechs, all these kinds of things. And that's the only thing that's going to make money when it's not backed by a dollar. And when you can, if that kind of thing plays out, it's like obviously like dramatically like, you know, bigger than you'd think it would be. And so it's just an asymmetric bet that's worth making. And so that's like one that I think sticks out. Obviously we backed Solana, but I think that was a bit of like a consensus view. You know, everyone knew that, you know, Tully and Raj and, you know, super smart guys onto something pretty big. And I think that was a bit more consensus. We made a lot of bets, man. Been in crypto for so long now. And a lot of stuff has gone up, right? And so, yeah, those are, I guess a couple of things.
How do y'all ever take like macro positional views in the way that you, whether it's deploying capital on the strategic side or even in the like more part of your quantitative analysis?
I don't think that's like our core edge. You know, we'll adopt like consensus macro views into our thinking, but it's not like we're predicting ahead on macro. Like, I don't think that's like what we have significant edge in. Obviously, you know, like our bet sizing and kind of everything else is informed by what the macro meta is like at all points in time. So across the board, that influences it. But I don't think we have an edge in predicting it.
And we got a chat question related to that, in that do you hold crypto on your balance sheet beyond like a outside of the strategic side? So like, say you're making a market, do you also hold like a non-delta neutral position in, say, Bitcoin and Ethereum and that kind of stuff on your balance sheet as a company?
Yeah, well, you got it, right? I mean, all crypto markets are fully pre-funded. And so if you want to make two-sided markets in Bitcoin, you got to have Bitcoin. And so even if you get flat by the end of the day, you got to have that Bitcoin to sit on. And so we sit on, you know, pretty significant amounts of crypto to participate across all the markets. You know, we're on like every exchange, try to play with a lot of size. You know, there's lots of the leverage venues, there's DeFi, there's all those kinds of things. And so you have to sit long. And obviously, if you want to be long, that's why we're in this space. You know, everything we're doing is to like, you know, be positioned to succeed when this space continues to go up. But yeah, we definitely do carry, you know, coins.
I'm stuck in a bunch of small cap coins. I've got no liquidity. If I DM you them, can you just saw it out for me?
Provide the liquidity. Can I dump on you?
Just hook it up. It's like really bad for me at the moment.
No one's ever like kindly asked me if they can dump on me.
I didn't say I would sell. I just want the liquidity to be better.
Right. You just need to test the liquidity.
On the thing where you're saying, you know, you didn't see these narratives play out so much, one of them was the institutional narrative. And I think maybe around a year ago now, you saw that sort of take off a bit with Bitcoin, right? You saw it was the start of the MicroStrategy going big. You saw Tesla buy, and Saylor hosted his CFO Bitcoin dinner party conference thing where people could come and learn about Bitcoin. And then it sort of fizzled out. You got Square, I think, have some on their balance sheet, and a few companies did. And then at the start of this year, KPMG, I think, bought one Bitcoin. Was it one? I think they bought a very small amount of Bitcoin and Ethereum. What do you think the barrier for those institutions was? Like, is it red tape or lack of belief, or do you think it's inevitable that sometime down the line it does play out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a giant amount of red tape, man. It's like, you know, everything has to go through about like 20 independent committees, and any one of them can veto it and kill it. And so, like, you know, we got past this one, but this one thing that has this one problem, you know, and it's like, you really need like kind of founder focus and like really like somebody who like has the focus to drive it, to really push it forward. You know, we saw that we backed with ICE, you know, they had like kind of founder focus. They pushed it through. Fidelity has the digital assets division. That's again, you know, kind of coming from top down. And so we're seeing a lot of those things kind of play out. And a lot of people are like very personally invested in crypto and excited about crypto at the highest levels. But they kind of push it and they got other things to do. And so it's like by attrition, it gets there, but it takes a damn long time. Obviously, you know, regulatory clarity is like the one thing that the whole industry has been beating the drum on forever. Like that'll help infinitely. The fact that Fidelity can custody your Bitcoins for you helps a lot for people, right? Instead of, you know, having to hold it on coins or give it to a company that you've never heard of before. And yeah, I think it's just naturally happening, right? Everyone's doing it. Like, I was in India for like the month of December, and there was like very it's like pretty unclear there. You know, it's like more murky there than it is even here by a lot. And still, like, everyone's like so motivated to try to get exposure. They're trying to, like, you know, work out all kinds of things. And so it's like, when that much will exists, you know, everywhere, and that much capital wants to come in, you got to believe that it's just going to happen. So that's my view.
Yeah, India was like second to China in the amount of times they've banned Bitcoin, I think. And like in 2017, they were in the news cycles for banning it, I think. Obviously, China do it once a month over the last 10 years. But and then this sort of cycle around as well, there was like a banning, unbanning type of thing. I don't know if it's just like fake news that I just read on Twitter or something, but I feel like I hear that quite a lot. So yeah, I guess it is more murky. Someone in the chat just said, please, for the love of God, get to the wormhole part. So, so I will take direction from Fernmatic and get to the wormhole part. So for the people that are watching that are like unclear, wormhole is built by Jump. Is that correct?
So we're one of the biggest contributors to wormhole, definitely. So Certus One was a company that we acquired like sometime last year. Yep. They built version one of the wormhole as a Solana hackathon project. And, you know, it was initially conceived as this Solana, Ethereum, and asset bridge. And once we brought them in-house, and, you know, those guys are like amazing. They're some of the best engineers in the space.
Kobe, did we judge that hackathon?
Yeah, I picked this as the winner.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Okay. I didn't do anything for any of the hackathons. I just put my picture on there and then didn't send me any information.
Same. I think I've gotten kicked off now.
Yeah, me too.
So we brought the Certus guys in, and once they came in, we kind of like conceived of Wormhole as this, you know, Wormhole V2 as this like far more powerful, expressive, generic solution. And so Wormhole as it exists today, you know, connects about 7 chains right now, and it enables like the movement of all kinds of information, right? So it's not only assets, it's like NFTs, Oracle data, governance information, contract calls, you name it, right? And so it's just meant to be like a protocol to facilitate cross-chain movement of information. And so from day one, it's been like governed by these 19 guardians, of which we are one. You know, and you have to have a supermajority to create any action on the bridge. You need a supermajority to upgrade stuff, you know, which of course had implications while the vulnerability was, you know, kind of being worked on. And so, you know, we were a big part of conceiving, you know, a lot of the design, a lot of the ideas, but there's really a number of folks that have been committing. So a number of the layer ones that committed, you know, have written code for this stuff and given ideas on design and code reviews. And there's other people hosting the front ends and integrating assets and all those kinds of things.
It might be like epicuricacistic to ask this, or like voyeuristic or something. And I just kind of want to know what it was like as it was happening in real time. Cause like sometimes you get a message and like a bad text and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, that's not great. But this is like $300 million is gone.
That's right.
Like, what's it like to receive that message? And what is it like to like have a team operate? Like it needs to be like operating at a high level, like a, you know, at their best when something so stressful is happening.
100%, man. So one of our devs like noticed like there was a discrepancy in ETH balances, and he was like, "Hey guys, you know, something's looking wrong," and he just put a bunch of people into Zoom. I joined like maybe like 6-7 minutes late, and you never join one of these things expecting you're going to be out 120k ETH, but you know you. We came on and, you know, we started to pull in all the audit firms, the security guys, other engineers in the space, and you know, quickly kind of came to the conclusion that there had been a vulnerability, been exploited to the tune of 120k ETH. And it's like a serious punch in the gut, right? Like you can kind of feel a bit of the silence on the call. But it was insane, man. Like everyone switched into problem solving mode so quickly. So quickly, you know, the devs were instantly like looking to assess the exact, you know, scale of the vulnerability and, you know, what the potential damage could be. Compliance guys were, you know, on with the exchanges, stablecoin providers trying to get those to shut down. Community managers were on with everyone on Discord and Telegram telling, you know, trying to communicate things. And then, you know, we of course had a decision to make on, you know, what we do with the funds. And you know, we're in like Miami right now on this offsite, and thankfully we had a bunch of like the decision makers in the room, and so quickly made the decision, you know, that we had to do this. It's never ever easy to make that kind of decision, But you know, it was like we'd like gameplay of some of the stuff out ahead of time. And you're like, you know, one of these like ultra high conviction projects of ours like is under duress. Like, you know, are we going to step in? And you know, we committed to that ahead of time, which makes you know it easier to do this. But it's never easy. And so we made the decision. I want to say like 8 minutes after I joined the call, like we knew exactly what the vulnerability was and what the scope of the damage was. And a couple hours in, you know, after having reviewed, tested, audited, the patch was in. And like 18 hours end to end, the bridge was back up, the funds were back in, the site was back up. And, you know, we were just kind of educating the community and you know, working on that kind of thing. And so, you know, not one like finger was pointed. No one blamed anyone. No one said anything. It was like, it was awesome, man. Like, you know, you never look back on losing $300+ million fondly, but like I definitely feel like amazingly proud of the team. Like it was an incredible response. And so yeah, man, it's definitely been a hell of a week.
So did you get to be like, we'll cover it, don't worry. Everyone sat there really stressed, like, oh God. And then you're like, no, we got it. Don't worry.
Feature of the president.
Instantly lighted up. Yeah. President says we got it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we were talking about like, you know, like how do we like what messaging are we going to put out? Like, we send a message out to the hacker on chain, you know, saying like, you know, there's a $10 million bounty, like get the funds back. And a couple of people on the chat were like, what should the number be? I'm like, what about just like start buying all this fucking ETH? Like just tell them like, you know, the $10 million is fine. I don't haggle for this one right now. And so it was a lot of those kinds of emotions, but you know, obviously it was a team decision and we had a bunch of people around and we talked about it. It was made in like less than a couple of minutes at most, but
Wait, so you had to buy the ETH? You didn't own it. You didn't have it in a wallet lying around. We need to market buy this ETH right now.
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it's all fungible. But like we did buy more ETH. Like the ETH that we have, you know,
it's
we want
stolen. Sorry, I don't mean that in like a funny way. Just ironic. You got to buy more ETH to pay for the ETH that was stolen.
Yeah.
Brutal.
And that's where, you know, having a global trading operation helps. You know, we were able to buy that size, you know, in fairly quick fashion without any crazy impact. And so then had the funds ready to put it back in.
And have you ever heard from the hacker? They never got back to you? They just started buying NFTs?
Yeah, they haven't started buying NFTs or replied to us yet. So
they've just done nothing?
Yeah, I mean, there's like been some movement, you know, there's a bunch of investigations going on. Like we're working obviously with the government, with private investigators, community, like people have reached out, tried to offer information. We have like a $10 million bounty out for any information leading to, you know, the recovery of the funds. And so, yeah, really hoping for like a motivated community response. Obviously, you know, we're very well versed with like on-chain forensics and, you know, all those kinds of things ourselves. And so trying to do everything we possibly can. Very, very motivated to get it back.
Yeah, it's interesting that like this happened and like a week later, the stolen Bitcoin from Bitfinex is like the people are like found and captured and like, yeah. It's like, if I was the hacker that stole the $300 million, which I'm not, if I was, I'd accept the $10 million to get it back right now. It'd be a good episode, wouldn't it? Yeah. I'll give you it back, hooray!
I was a white hat all along. I saved you from this one, really.
But yeah, they must be like, It might, that 10 mil looks more attractive when you see some people potentially going to jail for 20 years.
Or maybe they're just checking their Google Docs to make sure they didn't paste the private keys in there.
Yeah, maybe it's the same people. And then, like, after that happens, is it just, like, back to normal? Like, are the teams, like, just back to shipping and, you know, meetings go back to, like, business as usual? Or is there a different tone that follows?
Well, you know, it was a couple of days of pretty intense stress, right? Like people haven't slept. It's been like 24 hours. Like it's 18 hours end to end to like bring the bridge back up. And so no one slept. And, you know, then you're trying to like spend the whole next day, like bringing all the other services back up, making sure you're covering other vulnerabilities. You're talking about what happened. You know, a large part of the team that doesn't focus on Wormhole was business as usual. You know, there was like a couple of days of like, what happened? And, you know, everyone kind of wants to know. But yeah, the rest of the team really clicked back in and then, you know, after 2 days of sleep, Monday was back to shipping for sure. And so, yeah, the team is like just full bore ahead. You know, we've obviously got a couple of people focused on the investigation, but apart from that, yeah, back to business.
You know,
if any team members leave very suddenly and like start living a lavish life, is that why your investigations focus? Like, did you see Dave has just like moved to the Maldives? Like, he just lives on an island now.
Yeah.
I have a question about the governmental response to these things, because if somebody walks in a bank, robs a bank for $300 million of like gold bars or something, it's everywhere. It's huge. It's like it'd be the only story on the news. And this stuff happens in crypto, and it's not always 300 plus million, but it's, you know, 30 million here and 10 million there and 50 million there. And it's almost like you don't hear about it. So what is their interest in criminal activity where they're like crypto centric companies are the victims of this or individuals? And what's the process been like working with authorities?
Yeah. You know, I think they've been like highly supportive. They've been working on like digital asset crimes for like a while now. You know, obviously they've done a whole bunch of busts, Bitfinex being the most recent one. And so they're pretty motivated to help. Like, I don't think the attitude has been in the slightest that, you know, this is like out of our purview and like, you know, kind of sort it out yourself. Like, they're very motivated to help. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, I haven't been on the other side of this one on normal crimes. You know, this is one of my first interactions with one of these things. So I couldn't tell you how different it is, but it seems like it's the right approach.
You know? You weren't in Die Hard 3 or which for what?
Die Hard 3, the sequel to Die Hard.
Come on, there's so many Die Hards. Don't you watch the Christmas marathons?
I've seen Die Hard, but I haven't seen a sequel to Die Hard.
Kobe, you've gathered many internet points, but you lost some amongst the loyal crowd there. Anyway, sorry, where were you going? What's next?
I want to ask a bit about like kind of a shill your bag session, but not so much directly. I want to talk about how over the last year, ETH killers has been like a really popular trade. And you said earlier, you know, paying $100 to move ETH around is unacceptable. $300 million to plug a hole, that's good. But the $100 for the transaction is just it's breaking the bank. But it's been a very popular trade, and you know, you've seen ecosystems in a bunch of L1s like Solana and Avalanche, and you can go down CoinGecko and look at all the other ones and see how it's been one of the better trades of last year. Has played out. I'd love to hear your how you view that competition. It sometimes feels a little bit like a knife fight of people just like, I think Tezos just sponsored Manchester United Football Club or something. They're on the kits now, and you know, that seems to be happening more and more. They're realizing that this is the time to onboard users and build an ecosystem that should sustain for the future rather than something that just fizzles out quickly. So how do you see that entire ecosystem? Like, where do you think you should be placing attention? And do you think there is like a clear winner from that fight?
Yeah. Well, one, I think the competition is awesome. It's forcing everyone to perform at a level that's like completely unprecedented. The pace and the energy and the urgency which teams are feeling as a result of other people putting on moves, and like, you know, this ecosystem is like killing it on dev attention. Everyone is a hacker house. You know, this ecosystem is like great with the ecosystem funds and DeFi and NFTs, and like everyone's building it. And so the quality of the competition has been awesome. I don't think there's a winner. You know, I think we do live in this more multi-chain world, and you know, I also a cross-chain world. I know there's the multi-chain cross-chain debate right now, and we can get into that a little bit. But I think there's a number of like these mature ecosystems that have tremendous funding, smart people, real traction. And if we're going to make a bet that, you know, a lot of global commerce like ends up consolidating around these open rails because they're more efficient in some fashion, at least in some capacity, there's like never one computer that's big enough, right? Like to like process all of that, no matter how scalable and big their computer is and all those kinds of things. And so you got to bet that there's multiple environments that play around. Now, you know, there's the roll-up maxi kind of like approach to this. And, you know, we're very optimistic on roll-up. So like, don't mistake me there. You know, obviously we want our ETH.
Nice pun. Nice pun. Like the pun. Very optimistic on roll-ups. Good.
the And you know, I think those end up being a viable solution, especially for a lot of like specific things, like they end up being pretty strong. But there's a lot of other smart people focusing on like various geographies, various aspects, various like different things, right? The Polygon guys are like, if you go to any of the IITs in India, like what are people building on? It's Polygon. It doesn't matter like that one platform has this one like little edge on like this one technical aspect and uses a different language versus another one. Or like, you know, like Celo has been spending all this time in Latin America onboarding these payments people and getting the government comfortable and going to stores. And like now, because this new technology is 3% more secure and 5% more scalable, like no one's kind of switching. And so there's a lot of these like business and like real world use cases, and distribution is big. And so whenever we're making a bet on an ecosystem, on a project, like the technical like kind of scope is one. And like, you know, when you're betting on something like Solana early on, like, okay, they have a real differentiator. Like they've kind of figured out something that's going to enable them to, you know, scale a little bit more uniquely than others. And that's interesting. But there's also like, you know, are these guys going to be able to like actually attract people to work on this platform and build something? And, you know, are they attacking a geography and like, or a business line that's actually going to be meaningful and actually be able to compete there? And so the new L1 space is going to be pretty tough. You know, a lot of the guys are like shooting from uphill at this point. They've just got a lot of cash to attack problems and a lot of resources. But a lot of these like more multi-chain experiences are going to emerge. Like Celestia is kind of, you know, the new meta. It's kind of really hot right now. It's pretty cool. You know, it's got a lot of interesting properties. So you see those kinds of things play out. Once rollups become feasible, you know, those become interesting. But, you know, no one's waiting for those things to be built to like build everything else that they're doing. And so the innovation is like progressing super fast everywhere else as well. And so rollups will come and they'll iterate and they'll get to a point where they're affordable to use and, you know, they'll become kind of more exciting. And so definitely excited about like some of the ZK stuff that's being put there. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. I don't even remember what your question was, but
that's the best kind of podcast, honestly, where we just ramble the whole way through and then suddenly it's like, oh, wait, 2 hours have passed. That was a bit about like the L1 competition and like how you think it's going to play out. I'd love to talk a little bit about stuff where you have, like, you just don't get it. Cause like clearly you got the alt layer one trade, you get the roll up thesis. Like I've seen Solana building. I saw the thing the other day where you can pay, was it on like a normal terminal with Solana Pay, you could buy like a drink. And I saw him do it instantly. It was pretty cool. But then there's an other like categories of crypto. You know, there's like currency coins, you have like your Ripple and your Cardano that I struggle to categorize. I guess Cardano counts as an alternative layer one, sort of.
Y'all making markets on the Cardano chain.
Yeah, I'm trying to like, I guess the question is like, is there stuff that you're fundamentally skeptical of and you just think is like a bad idea or a bad execution in the market that you don't really understand? Maybe Ledger can explain to you why it's good afterwards. He might not be able to as well.
Well, I'd love to hear it, but I think a lot of these are also maybe more consensus views now. Like a lot of like the GameFi stuff seems to be way, way, way overhyped. Like single game raising $400 million valuation, we'll sell your token and we'll build a game at some point, you know, trustless kind of thing. Like that's like so overplayed. Metaverse is exciting, it's real. You know, we led the Metaplex round, very optimistic on Solana NFTs, also quite optimistic on like one chain really being able to build the infrastructure to like have NFTs going forward. Like it requires a shit ton of focus to build a stack that people can actually build on top of. Like you got the 721, but like, or like the equivalent standard everywhere else, but you need a lot more tooling on top of the standard. And so not everyone's going to have the focus to, I think, keep building on top of those things, but I guess that's a bit of an aside. But the metaverse stuff, I think, is like just a bit too crazy right now. Anything credible is like a $500 million valuation and everything else is a bit of a cash grab. I think that market gets way too overheated. What else do I not get, man? The meme coins, I think like everyone gets at this point. Like it's like, you know.
I couldn't fundamentally explain to you why a dog coin goes up.
Right.
Yeah. Not convincingly.
Do you think they have staying power?
It's had staying power a lot longer than I thought it would. I'm not willing to take the other side of that trade right now. But it seems like people really value these memes and like owning a piece of this culture, right? And it's like a bit contrarian and it's like anti-systemic, and people seem to want to commit capital into it. And you know, we've been consistently surprised by the amount of capital that retail can commit over the last 2 or 3 years. And I think at this point it would be a bit foolish to like, you know, bet against that. In my opinion, you know, it could go all the way down to zero, but it's not a bet that I'm going to make.
I got one from chat, actually. I think it's a really good question. And it's one of the ones that I don't understand, is social tokens. Like people sort of tokenizing themselves, I guess.
Yeah, I don't get that one.
Tokenizing a community. Don't get it?
Yeah, so tokenizing a person, I don't get. You know, social network kind of things, I think I do get. Like, I think that's...
Lend you a bullish bit clout?
DSO now.
DSO now, yeah, they have to change to rebrand already.
Yeah, but I'm generally bullish that meme, right? Like I think those kinds of things like gotta exist and they will. Like that I feel pretty confident about. Like the, you know, I don't know if those some influencer recently does viral on Twitter. I'm having like memory loss now.
How do you feel about the Potter call? Have you seen that one?
Man, I haven't even seen that one.
It's universal basic income for pets.
Oh shit! Yeah. Oh god. Well.
Now listed on Coinbase.
No. That's been a little bit crazy.
Yeah. Coinbase listing $30 million market cap assets is that's 10 wormhole hacks. Like,
no,
it's a tenth of a worm. It's a tenth of a wormhole hack. It's just. It's weird. It's weird. Anyway, Brian's probably never coming on this podcast, is he?
In disclosure of what they've said now, which is different from what they had previously said, they had this digital asset framework listing policy acronym thingy that was like all this due diligence to list something. And then they were like, here's protocol, and you know, and they're like, this is obviously in line with our policy, which somewhere in the middle they had published, you know, talked about a new policy of we basically want to list every token, so here we'll start with these. So they obviously transitioned their strategy somewhere along the lines that, but they didn't really express what that switch was. But I think it seems clearly like they're going to engage in the whatever regulatory arbitrage or what, you know, something, and list everything they can and ask for forgiveness if it's appropriate, or just restrict jurisdictions from trading certain things if it doesn't seem to fit the criteria, and, you know, just be more flexible in a regulatory sense.
There's a new Cryptopia, mate. It's Cryptopia days where it's Coinbase. I'd love to talk a bit about that. The roll up, like Vitalik's blog post, basically, you know, the roll up centric multi-chain future, or the true multi-chain with bridges. Like, does the wormhole hack or exploit give additional credibility to Vitalik's thesis, or do you still see a world where, you know, people are jumping from Harmony to Luna to Solana to like chains that don't exist yet, and then maybe to Cardano?
So one thing out of the gates was, you know, this was a smart contract book, right? This exists on single chain applications, much like it does on multi-chain applications, much like it does on cross-chain bridges and roll-up bridges and any other bridge, right? This is just a problem in the implementation of things. Like, this same bug could have drained all the funds from Uniswap if it existed, as an hypothetical. It was just wasn't sanitizing the inputs correctly as part of an action. As part of, like, the conversation, like, more broadly, is, like, you got to consider things final at some point, right? Like, you got to have, like, finality in blockchains at some point. Like, you talked about Solana Pay. When you're making a payment, when you're depositing funds to and from an exchange, when you're hedging a trade on from a DEX, when you're like paying somebody ETH USDC for your Polkadot SAF round, like those are all like, I don't know, cross-chain interactions. And, you know, they become increasingly more complex and they create this web of interactions over time. And, you know, yeah, a roll-up centric approach where all of global commerce settles down to ETH L1 has better trust assumptions, but, you know, misses on all the other human stuff. And so, you know, trust assumptions aren't everything. You know, there's going to be dozens of computer environments out there that continue to like build on value, and that people inherently have to consider final in some form or the other. And so, you know, they will continue to build their own competitive advantages And those comparative advantages will then compose well with comparative advantages from other chains. And bridges will help do that, right? Like invoking contract calls, assets, NFTs, whatever it is. You know, moving your apes to Ethereum to go to a bigger audience, or moving USD as a collateralized value, and, you know, all the other creative shit that I'm not thinking of right now. And so very optimistic on a multi-chain future from a highly pragmatic lens, in my view. And if you guys have other views, I'd love to hear it. But
I think get back to the justification for plugging the gap on Wormhole hack. It was part of that conviction, I presume, because the whole point in Wormhole seems to be connectivity between all of these things. So that's you essentially putting, you know, putting
money where your mouth is.
Where your mouth is on this idea that connectivity between all of these means that all of these are going to stick around in some form or fashion.
Yeah, they're going to stick around, and that, you know, infrastructure like Wormhole is going to, you know, be critically important and capture a big chunk of that value in the market. So yeah, definitely a big bet on that.
Can you express like how's Wormhole fit in amongst the kind of the competitive landscape and like various trade-offs that can exist, whether that's centralization or dependencies on, you know, with oracles or whatever else. I don't really know how it works, but I know there's these different solutions. You know, there's everybody's favorite bag. What, you know, we don't need to name them, but like give the case for Wormhole versus other attempts at solving similar problems.
Yeah, so Wormhole, you know, it's got these 19 guardians. You need 2/3 of the guardians to do something. You know, it's not a centralized bridge. Jump's not running it, but you need 2/3 of these guardians to do something, right? There's these other like light client based bridges, you know, which definitely do have better trust assumptions, you know, more theoretically, because, you know, you're able to validate the chain, you're able to process all the headers, you're kind of going to be able to do things in a more pure fashion. When you have a chain like Solana that, you know, produces that much stuff, like it's hard to build a light client for it effectively. And so a chain like, you know, Ethereum or basically any other chain can't process that. And so you can't connect it using these things. There are like efforts on fancier cryptography and cooler shit to make that possible. And the way Wormhole is designed is to like take out like every piece is like highly modular, right? And so like if a better mechanism for like establishing trust and for like verifying an action on a chain comes into place, like you can swap out like this 2/3 thing and you can stick that in instead. But it's a highly pragmatic approach at getting it going. It takes a lot of being out there in the market, iterating and like responding to what people want to build a good product. And a lot of those components will continue to keep building, and things can get swapped out, right? The IBC type solutions are great. You know, I think IBC is a very strong protocol, but it does require this light client thing that's not possible yet. There's the roll-up bridges, but those only work back to L1. And so those are, you know, those are good, and you know, they have good trust assumptions and better trust assumptions than Wormhole has from those chains to the L2s, because, you know, there's dispute resolution. And that's kind of like a, you know, I think broadish picture of the solution space.
For better or for worse, it seems like one of the ones that, and maybe I could be wrong, I'm missing some, but like I recall the Avalanche bridge, right? I think it's just a multisig or something. So there's a lot of trust assumptions, but there's not a lot of technology involved. So just moving that money back and forth is relatively straightforward as long as you trust those people. Do you think in the long term we'll get there from a security perspective to say like, okay, you know, Wormhole or what other solutions, whoever wins, or if there's multiple winners, even better, that will be clearly and obviously better than kind of these trusted but kind of low tech solutions?
Yes, kind of as a one line answer. But you know, a lot of the bridges that are like out there today are all basically effectively threshold signatures of some sort. So I think the AVAX one is like 2 of 3, Polygon's probably about the same, with some commits back to Ethereum for extra security. Wormhole's got 19. There's others that have similar kind of, I think, thresholds. I think as like cryptography like advances and we're able to do some of this light client proofs faster, like I think we will have better tech. There is a lot to be said for simplicity though, and I think that's kind of like, you know, what you were hinting on there. Like in more lines of code means more exploits, right? Like the Wormhole exploit wasn't a problem in its trust assumption, right? Like no one, like there's nothing inherently wrong with the architecture of the bridge that caused this money to go away. It was a smart contract bug. And as you write more complex bridges, there's more lines of code and there's more possibilities for exploits. And so a lot of this will come through the fire. But like a big core principle that I think all good bridges have kind of been following is in minimizing the lines of code to make it as simple as possible.
I've got some questions about other stuff that Jump's building, but I want to decipher a question from chat. Ledger, how do you think the logic Jump's happened for this comment to occur? Wormhole bridge makes me think about Dune. Great movie.
Well, you know, it's summertime in June. Flowers are out.
No, Dune, the movie, not June.
Dune. Oh, Dune. I thought you said June the month. Now, Dune, the movie, well, because there's like this interstellar travel, and you got to take this, you got to, you know, absorb the spice in order to be able to see time and space and the spectrum so that you can effectively navigate through this empty space. So, like, they just.
And if the spice is gone, Jump will replace it.
That's right.
Well, thank you for your contributions, whoever that was that said that.
About, alternatively, I forgot about the worms in the sand itself. That's more meta, though, like the, you know, on doing it. So, anyway.
Yeah, there's worms in the sand and they create holes.
Yeah.
I want to ask about other things Jump building, because you mentioned, you know, there's a few people in the team dedicated to trading, but the majority of people are dedicated to, like, you know, building and researching in the space. Have you done a secret 10K profile picture NFT drop that we don't know is actually Jump? Or, like, what else is going on that is Jump branded that I might not know about?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the space that we've helped write the code for. And so, you know, there's like a couple of Terra projects that are coming up that we, you know, that you'll see a lot of commits from our side. The Pith network was one that I kind of brought up early on. And so that's like an Oracle project on Solana. It's getting financial data from Jump, all its other peers, regulated US equity exchanges, all your crypto people, FTX, Galaxy, CoinShares, Alameda, kind of all those folks. And you're creating like a first party data source for, you know, contracts to settle on Solana. That's one that we've been like super excited about. It's been one where, like, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, like, we've been able to convert a zero-sum game between all these highly competitive people into a positive someone and creating something like good. And so that's been very, very exciting. And everyone that's been involved has been like super like engaged, which has been really cool. The Terra projects that I, you know, mentioned that we've been excited about were Prism and Nebula. There was actually an NFT project too. And so there's the Solana did like one of its I think its first hacker house things in Chicago with our new hire class. And so every time like Jump hires like the new quant class, like, you know, we had like, I think 12, 15 folks in that particular class, they go through like C++ and machine learning and like a bunch of other stuff that's relevant to the trading environment. And this time we prefaced all of that with like a Solana bootcamp. So they did 2 weeks of that. They learned how to, you know, build on Solana, and then they decided that they wanted to keep doing it. And so gave them like a couple months to like do stuff with the help of like a couple other senior devs. And they built like this thing called Extend. And, you know, then they handed it off to other people. Like, it's obviously not like it was like a really fun experiment for like folks to work on. And it's like a million NFT drop on Solana just to like showcase the power of Metaplex, that kind of thing. Cause we led their investment. We wanted to like show some support and build some stuff and actually see, you know, what it's kind of about and see what we could contribute back. And so they dropped it, and it's like this thing where there's like all these neighborhoods, and it's like a pixel grid, you know, much like many others, but then it's got like this Z dimension, and like, you know, different things mean different things on each layer. And yeah, it was kind of cool, man. It's a there's like people coming in from the new grad program, and they thought this was a, you know, fun thing to build, and they built it in a couple months and they shipped it. And I think they're, you know, far more valuable to us now having done that. We've been working on like the Certus One acquisition, like, also involved the acquisition of a bunch of infrastructure, and so they run validators. They're amongst the biggest validators on Terra, Solana, Cosmos, a couple other chains, and so we've been thinking about how to, you know, optimize some of those validator clients, and, you know, kind of working with the teams to optimize performance, you know, working with Solana to like debug some of the issues that have been coming up recently, with Terra and a few other people as well. working on like just some general research stuff on governance. We had this recent piece out by one of our new economic researchers on like governance, voting powers, and making a bunch of investments. And so, yeah, there's so much shit going on, man. It's just it's hard to even keep it all in your head. But yeah, there's a lot of really really cool projects being built out, and I think we've got like a really strong body of very good blockchain engineers at this point that can go build things. So that's what I'm like most excited about.
On the validator side, I know Certus run a ton, and I think they're like highly reputable as well. I knew of them prior to your acquisition. Do you do much stuff with MEV? Like, how do you see the future of MEV on, you know, proof of stake chains? And because I guess in some ways, like Jump, it should be your bread and butter, right? But at the same time, the ecosystem's not super developed yet. There's like a lot of people running bots from their home that are like just printing money. I don't know if you saw the one guy conceded his bot to there was two people competing, and one guy conceded and open sourced his bot and wrote a message to his competitor like, "You've been a great competitor, I'm kind of giving up."
Eight bot.
Awesome.
Yeah, eight bot. And then the other guy wrote back like, I'm beating you because I have more money, I can pay higher gas fees, like trade up and then come challenge me or something. It was like a great anime storyline. But yeah, I'd love to hear like how you see MEV and like the future of that, especially as ETH as well moves to proof of stake this year.
Yeah. One, you know, I don't think MEV is inherently bad. We haven't done a whole bunch of MEV, so I'll just say that out of the gates. You know, we understand it fairly well. We've played with it. We know what the systems look like. We've never been involved in like sandwich trades and those kinds of things. Like, that's just not something that we wanted to be involved in. As we go to proof of stake, like MEV is going to go with it. Things like flashbots are going to consolidate. The things I worry most about is, you know, kind of the censorship resistance aspects of it. Like with flashbots, like becoming a centralized piece of infrastructure that stands in between everyone else. And, you know, the guys that are building it are good guys, of course, but, you know, that's not the assumption that you want to work with in this space. So that's that kind of one thing. If you can get like a slightly more decentralized source of, you know, prioritizing transactions, and I think that's likely to develop. As proof of stake matures, you know, I think some people have been worried about like, you know, if you control a lot of stake, then you can order transactions, and that makes it like, you know, that makes it better for you to like, you know, squeeze people on things or those kinds of things. And I think at the end of the day, like, you have two options, right? You can either order the transactions yourself to include your own transactions, so you can accept a batch and get paid for it. And which of those things ends up being more economically profitable for you is the one that you'll end up doing. And so if the market has more alpha than you, then they're just going to take that option because they're extracting more edge and they're willing to pay more for it. And so I think there's a bit of like, you know, people getting spooked out about things. So I don't feel personally as like scared about it per se. I think the MEV like structure is pretty interesting and pretty cool. Like, you know, it's basically converted like the whole market into like a continuous batch auction. And in traditional like high frequency literature, people have always like talked about the fact that, you know, the FIFO matching at like the exchange venues is becoming like, you know, has negative externalities on the world. So, you know, because of the speed race, you have all these like insane infrastructure investments that are arguably not adding much to the world and, you know, those kinds of things. And that we should consolidate on like auctions within certain slots to make it so that, you know, the speed advantage is only good up at some point and the amount of jitter is pretty good. And MEV kind of naturally forced that with flashbots. And so I think, you know, it's a cool experiment. It's also like why, like, I think I find DeFi like just really fucking awesome. Like, things just iterate so fast. Like, market structure back in the day, like in the ETH client, like at one gas level, at one price, transactions would be ordered randomly. And so you're incentivized to just stuff as many transactions in as you possibly could. Right. And it's like kind of like liken that to like open outcry pits where you just got to like make yourself big and you kind of most like somewhat pseudo randomly get selected for the trade. And then like one person just decided like, you know, this doesn't make sense. Let's order it price time. And then it became FIFO matching. And it wasn't anyone at the Ethereum Foundation. You know, it was a community member, and you know, that makes the whole market better. And then you iterate flashbots, which becomes continuous batch auctions. And you have like multiple kinds of MEV bots. You've got Eden, you've got all these things. And in real time, we're like iterating on all this market structure like a billion times faster than would ever be possible. And that's just fucking awesome, right? And it's possible because you can export this trust, right? Like in the traditional markets, you have the clearinghouse, FCM, DCM, all these other three-letter acronyms, you know, that are needed to basically establish trust in the system so that once a buyer and a seller match on the engine, that the trade will actually settle. And with crypto, the match is the settle. You know, you export the trust of the settlement to the chain, to Solana, to Ethereum, to wherever you're trading. And like, that's just powerful, right? And I think that's just pretty exciting. So that was a bit of a rant, but
it's super cool. Why do you think that like original DeFi has been performing so poorly, I guess, for the last 12, 18 months? Did old DeFi top in summer 2020, Ledger?
February 9th, 2021. that was when it topped in dollar terms. ETH terms, I'm not sure it actually made new highs throughout that January and early February run-up. I think it topped
I think Chainlink topped in ETH terms in August 2020.
Yeah, Link definitely did. But even like Aave, kind of the stand-in for that, kind of fast runners in January. I still am not sure if it hit like ETH relative all-time highs versus what it did in August, September 2020.
Yeah. Why do you think it's performed so poorly? And what did you think to this DeFi 2.0 wave, which was the same stuff with parameter changes and different logos?
Yeah, I mean, people wanted new games, right? So we
yeah.
Like, it's more, it was fun for a little while. I think they were like obviously overinflated for a while, right? Like people were farming the shit out of them. There were all the Pool 2 games that were like hyping everything back up, and eventually you run out of tokens to play Pool 2 games, and then things came back down. And then we played Pool 2 games on new DeFi, we played games on NFT. And so I think at like some point, I mean, it's not a perpetual motion machine, and like DeFi 1.0 had to stop kind of running up. I'm like pretty impressed and happy with like where it's held up relative to where it could have gone. And so, you know, these things are still trading at pretty big numbers. And so, yeah.
It seems like DeFi as technology has stayed fairly sticky. DeFi tokenomics have been like hot garbage broadly.
Yeah. 3-3, 3-3, baby.
Man, 3-3 is like, that was the evolution and then died. And, you know, that's, I'm just even thinking about back to the stuff that was hot in DeFi summer. You know, Chainlink obviously kind of front ran all of it, did well through the bear market. But then you had Aave and Uniswap and Sushi and all those borrowing and lending protocols, DEXs, and other stuff in DeFi that just has struggled. I don't even know. It never really recovered from a tokenomics perspective. Maybe it just needs years, like kind of like Zcash or something, but hopefully not that bad, to kind of bleed out, get the tokens in circulation, and then figure out like how do they accrue value. I don't know.
I think so, man.
Hey, Zuko's agreed to come on. Can you stop dunking on Zcash till after?
Yeah, sorry. I'm not dunking on it. Good tech. But Aave is a great freaking product, you know, what it actually does. And then they're not stopping either, as an example. Like, they're, you know, most of these teams are still building stuff. They're going, I think, the wallet route. But there's every single one of them, I think, is just kind of becoming a decentralized bank, which is fascinating for long-term stuff.
And that's exciting. You know, I think a lot of these people are going to push towards better user experiences just to have their product more used. And that's going to, like, drive innovation on that space. Aave is like one of the teams that keeps building. I think, you know, they have the V3 stuff where Aave on multiple chains becomes more than brand value. You know, they actually share balance sheets and stuff, and so they're doing creative, innovative things. And so, yeah, it's nice to see folks kind of stay committed.
Ledger, we're almost hitting time. I have a handful of questions left. You got a couple more, or shall I go for the quick fire?
I have one more question about wormhole stuff.
After you, go for it.
Does it solve kind of this liquidity fragmentation problem where, like, say, Sushi is deployed on 15 different blockchains, liquidity has to be everywhere? Is it centralized liquidity, or how's that work?
Yeah, so there's like a couple of vectors to how it tries to attack that. One is, you know, tokens like in the wormhole ecosystem are path independent, and so if you take your USD from Solana to Ethereum to Polygon, it's the same asset as, you know, same mint address as directly from Terra to Polygon. And so that makes it easier for funds to flow through. You're not like triple and quadruple wrapping things, which makes things, you know, far more efficient. And so as long as you consolidate on standards, that helps. There's also a bunch of like cross-chain swap stuff being built so that, you know, you go straight into the native asset. And so say you have something like USDC or Tether or USD or, you know, name your favorite intermediary coin. You can swap into the intermediary asset on one chain, bridge that over, swap back out all in one click. And, you know, that makes it so that, like, if you don't want to use that to collateralize things or, like, use that in that DeFi ecosystem, like, you don't need to move it there just to move it. And so that makes, that helps in some aspects. And then you don't need, like, this N by N liquidity matrix. You just kind of, you know, go N by one, one by N, and that makes it a lot more straightforward.
And then which either semi-competitive or maybe completely competitive protocol that sees this problem do you find the most interesting as a different solution or you know kind of respect their game?
Yeah, I think there's credible competitors in the space, which is great. You know, that's like really been much like for the layer ones, it's been a kick in the team's butt to like keep moving, keep pushing forward. Layer zero is great; they got a good team. Axelar, you know, they've been building for a really long time. Those two kind of stand out to me as like, you know, folks that have similar visions on, you know, fully generic communication between all these chains to build expressive things. And so, yeah, those are the two that kind of jump out most.
Cool. Thanks. Your turn.
Yeah, I got a few, and I know you got to run. So the first one is like, what do you want to see more of in crypto over the next couple of years? Like, is it, you know, more Irene DAO type type stuff, or like where do you think what are you hoping people build over the next couple of years? What do you think is missing, I guess, from the ecosystem?
Yeah, more of what Phantom built, you know, like their user experience seems so awesome. Like I saw, you know, we also the same video on Twitter, you know, with Solana Pay, like when like you can build those kinds of experiences more seamlessly where users can come in and just play with these things, like that becomes dramatically more easy. You know, like I always have friends saying, you know, like, how do I use my wallet? And then folks get confused when you have to move funds from one wallet to the other. Like, no one knows what a seed phrase is, what any of these things are. And people end up being highly confused. And so better user experiences, for sure. The infrastructure plays have been getting super hot. You know, we've seen, like, so many multi-billion dollar raises, you know, from Figment, Alchemy, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, getting to that truly AWS-like experience where you're able to build on these apps strongly. You know, we saw the Moxie post where like he talks about the fact that none of this is decentralized. There's a few people trying, you know, there's some of those honesty systems for decentralizing RPCs. But I think just more involved like systems so that like everyone that's building an app is not running all their own servers and like figuring out all these things. And it's like, it's really slowing innovation down. It's very hard to do for a lot of the more involved chains. And so more of that for sure. Just you know, on the gaming and metaverse side, like I just want to see like a real game where I can actually like have fun playing it. like I just want to like, you know, I want to have fun playing a game and like move assets around and really like have that thesis play out a little bit. And then like on the research side, like very interested to see like where all the ZK stuff goes. If like, you know, it becomes computationally effective, like there's a lot of interesting hardware acceleration things that are going on there to make things going. And I like, you know, I guess like an underlying theme of all of this is like we're like highly infrastructure focused. And like, you know, not very prescriptive about what gets built. You know, I don't think I have a lot of amazing creative vision there. And so it's a lot of like enabling things.
The next question is from chat. It says, where did you get your GM hoodie?
Yeah, that was probably the one that's been asked the most.
Yeah, my girlfriend gave it to me for my birthday recently.
Where's it from? We can't just ask your girlfriend.
Bring her on the stream.
Yeah, we'll have to send that to the...
Is it a custom build? Is it LOL DeFi?
I think it is custom build. I don't know. Maybe I can find out.
Okay.
We'll put it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes.
Look, it's very popular, and I'm raising money for a GM hoodie company at a $300 million valuation if you're interested. So I'll hit you up after the show. All right. On the show, at the very end, we asked the same question to guests unrelated to crypto, more of like a life or philosophical question, perhaps. And it's just what, like sort of, a piece of information, a piece of life advice, maybe a mantra, have you found yourself reflecting on often in life that has helped you be more successful or happier or healthier or whatever? Just a piece of alpha that they can take on and go, all right, maybe I can be president as well one day.
Yeah. I'll give like a bit of like a work or a business one. And that's, you know, kind of like one that I've like just learned to absorb a lot, that I reflect on a lot from, you know, the kind of like the folks that have been here at Jump for a while. And it's like really like harnessing the power of asymmetric upside, you know, where you can, if you recognize asymmetric opportunity, and you can lay a lot of bets, and then really have the conviction to like throw the kitchen sink at things that are working, and then keep doubling down. And, you know, I think it's easy to say and just really, really hard to do. You know, like the $300 million call that we kind of made last week. You know, I don't think, you know, we would have been in a position to make that without having reflected on that infinitely. And so, you know, we feel pretty good that that's going to pay off well in the long term. You know, it's a big hit, but we're here for a long, long time, and there was a lot of shit running on it. So that's one that has been top of mind for the last week for me, at least.
Like it.
Thank you, boss. Ledger. Want to read us out?
Yes, sir. Kanav, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You can follow him on Twitter. We'll put the links on the show notes, and also go to jumpcrypto.com. Check out what they're doing. They got some cool writing on their website too that we didn't get to today, but it's very good. And also thanks so much to FTX for being our partners for Up Only TV. Go to uponly.tv/FTX. Trade there today. Earn yield, all that good stuff. Track your portfolio. Check out their Super Bowl ad this Sunday. You can do that. Thanks, y'all, for being here. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.